The projector starts, and so begins this episode of Movie Nights and Matinees, the podcast for people who enjoy movies from when we actually had to go to the movies. I'm your host, Bill Groves, and this is episode 29, Weaving Worlds, in which my guest and I dive into the subject of motion picture production design. So sit back, relax, and take a moment to take in your surroundings.
Yeah, quite a layout. My favorite style, Chinese provincial.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening. I should start off by mentioning that, as with the last couple of episodes, today I'll be yet again without the participation of my co-host, Jim Reed. He missed out on episode 27 due to being away for the Kansas Silent Film Festival, and due to being under the weather, he missed out on episode 28, though part of that was also due to the recording of that episode having been delayed by some technical issues. In fact, that interview was re-recorded only yesterday, and I'm sorry to report that as of today, Jim hasn't quite bounced back, but I'm confident he'll be back for episode 30. In any case, over the course of the episodes thus far, Movie Nights and Matinees is largely focused on specific movies and series or groups of movies centered around a particular theme or origin. In the last episode, we veered away from that a bit in looking specifically at one element found in movie productions, which was the composition of songs that were utilized in a variety of ways in the completed pictures for which they were created. Today, we'll be looking at another aspect of motion picture production, one without which there'd be precious little for us to see on the screen. That is the art of production design. Whether a movie takes place in the distant past, in some unique corner of the present, or in the far-flung future, the richness of the audience experience is often in the hands of the artists and craftsmen who weave the world in which the story unfolds. With that in mind, I invite you to listen in, as I'm educated on the subject, by Kathy Whitlock, author of the book Designs on Film, A Century of Hollywood Art Direction. Kathy, welcome to Movie Nights and Matinees.
Hi, Bill. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this. I've got to say, just off the top, there might be a more appropriate place for me to insert this, but I just don't want it to go unsaid. Your book, I think, is the most gorgeous book that I have added to my reference library. It's just such a pleasure to look through. And I'll get into a little more detail on that later on. But for now, can you just give us, kind of introduce yourself, give us an idea of your background?
Okay, well, I have sort of a circuitous background that made me go from college to where I am now, and everything kind of, the puzzles all kind of fit together as to what I'm doing. Right after college, I moved to New York City immediately and got a job at Universal Pictures. And it was a very small staff of about six people, and I was, you know, low person on the totem pole, having just gotten out of college. And I worked in marketing and publicity. And the very first film I worked on was Animal House, which I kind of lived in college. So that was that made it really easy. Oh, but yeah. Anyway, I've just always been such a huge film person. And working at a studio was just fantastic, learning about everything. And then after that, I went on to become an interior designer years later. I decided not to move to L.A. when the staff was closed in New York. And became a designer for about, worked probably about 15 years doing that. And I was at a house one day in New York, apartment in New York. It was on Park Avenue. And the woman had just seen that movie, Someone to Watch Over Me, with Tom Berenger and Mimi Rogers. And she said, I want my living room to look like this. And so this, you know, just bell went on in my head, light, whatever you want to call it. And I thought, wow, that there's such a correlation between design and movies that, you know, audiences, many people I talk to go to see movies just for the design, myself included. So I became a journalist. I ironically had a journalism minor, and I've been writing about designs and movies and television ever since.
Wow. Now, I have to ask this, because when I saw the book and your name, my mind immediately went to Albert Whitlock. And he does get mentioned in your book in association with The Birds, the Hitchcock film. Are you related to him?
We're not related, but I did meet him when I was at Universal, and he was the nicest, most genteel man I've ever been around. Just lovely. I'm just crazy about him. So, and we joked about, you know, the fact we weren't related. A lot of people think I'm his granddaughter, but I'm not. I wish I were. <It's just> fantastic. So.
Yeah. Now, in telling your story about being asked to design the apartment to look like the one in the movie, that actually just reminded me of something. One of my favorite directors is Walter Hill. Mm-hmm. And I got to meet him when I first moved to the LA area back in the late 80s. And I had the chance to ask him, you know, in your movies, what's the deal with torchies? Because in at least three films, there is a bar or a nightclub something called Torchies. And so he told me that it goes back to the driver. He was talking with his production team, and there apparently was a bar actually called Torchies that he used to, he and his associates would go kind of hang out in, I guess, in between production days or at the end of a production day, something like that. And he, in approaching the driver, told him, okay, we got this scene in a bar, make it Torchies, by which he only meant replicate the look.
Right.
But the design team took him literally. And it was dubbed Torchies in the film. And so that just kind of carried over into some other ones. So I thought that was kind of a fun story.
And that's what we call an Easter egg.
Yeah. There you go. So what prompted you to create this gorgeous book?
You know, there just wasn't anything out there like it at all. I mean, there have been several books done in the past on Art Deco, a couple that are really wonderful. And there's another called Setting the Scene that Robert Sennett wrote years ago, but nothing that was really new. And I took it to HarperCollins and got a book deal like immediately. They were just all over it. So I was thrilled about that. And I keep thinking I'm going to do another one. But, you know, with the movie photo rights like they are now and Getty zoning everything, it's a horse of a different color, as they say in the South. So,
yeah. Well, again, praising the book, the photos, it goes beyond what you would normally find in a movie reference book, which is typically things like poster art and production stills that were intended to be released as promotional material. But you've got a lot of production and pre-production art in there, gorgeous sketches, drawings, things like that, as well as just, I guess, what would you call them? Not continuity photos, I guess, but well, I guess some of them may be, but just definitive set photos.
Set to still, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and you get some looks at some behind the scenes personnel in some of those.
There's a wonderful company called PhotoFest out of New York, and they have been collecting stills for probably like the past 50 years. It's just incredible what all they have. And the majority of things they have are the pre-production behind the scenes, which is really what everybody wants to see. Because some, you know, now, especially when I write articles, I've written over 200 right now on set stories. And I'm just getting so tired of the traditional publicity shot. And it's just hard unless the production designer, you know, take some photos on his own or does some sketches. It's just a real scramble trying to find, you know, good pictures. But anyway, I was very fortunate on the book that PhotoFest existed.
Yeah, you never know what you're going to find in those. I remember when I was working at Warner Brothers in the archives, at one point I was cataloging a set of continuity stills from Cheyenne Autumn. Mm-hmm. And there was an item, it had an inventory of the props and things that were in the scene. And one of the props was described as Indian artifact. And it was in a set that was, I believe it indicated it was Carl Malden's office. Hmm. And up on a mantle is this Indian artifact. It was the Maltese Falcon.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. Well, Warner's got a great photo archive. And they've got a good prop department, too. So.
Yeah. Anyway, so back to the book. Now, the way it's structured, you start out by, I guess you would call them the founding fathers, sort of, so to speak, of production design, art direction, and you make the distinction between those terms, too. So can you tell us something about the distinction and maybe some of those early names?
Yeah, and I want to interject this now. A person that wrote the book with me is Tom Walsh, who used to be the head of the Art Directors Guild. So he wrote the chapter on production designers and just a wealth of knowledge. So I couldn't have done it without him. But yeah, we wanted to kind of start to educate the audience about what a production designer is and what an art director is. And whenever I lecture people, that's one of the questions they're always asking. And I tell people, it's like if you have a house, and the production designer would be your architect. The art director would be the person that's doing all the renderings, and the set decorator is your interior decorator. And of course, art direction was a term that was used from the inception of film up until 1939, and then they changed it to production design. But when you watch the Academy Awards, it's still best Oscar for art direction. So go figure. I can't explain that one. And some of the art directors, I was fortunate to still meet a lot of them working on this book before they passed away. I spent an afternoon with Robert Boyle, who, you know, of course, did a lot of Hitchcock's movies, and he just had tons and tons of great stuff. Henry Bumstead, who did a lot of Westerns for Clint Eastwood and worked with Hitchcock. Dick Silbert, who used to be head of the Paramount, and he did Chinatown and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and quite the character. So then they were all just really wonderful and gracious about opening up their, you know, vault for me, which was great because nothing's really been done on all this.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that as a moviegoer, it varies because in some instances, the film's creators want you to notice the setting, the world you're in, and maybe details here and there, because that's part of the thrust of the film. And in others, it's not so much they want you to notice it, but they want you to absorb it without necessarily being conscious of it.
Well, you know, and when you go to a film and you feel like you've gone for 2 hours to Rick's place in Casablanca, or you've been on the plantation at Terra, or you've, you know, been in a surreal city like as in Blade Runner, and you leave the theater and it just took you away for those 2 hours. And it's all about the believability. And that's when a production designer has really done his job. And I've been on a ton of movie sets, and I'll go and write about it, and I'll may go back and see the movie again. And I forget that I was on the set. I feel completely absorbed into the movie. And that's why I think so many of us go to films is because it's the great escape. I mean, it's just wonderful to be transported other places.
Yeah. And as I say, in the early part of the book, you have that section where you go through some of the founding fathers of the art. And then it transitions to you start doing a decade by decade breakdown. Right. And I found that interesting because especially early on, well, you start with the silent era, and there was all kinds of amazing stuff in the silent era. And I got to think, Intolerance, Ben-Hur, Thief of Baghdad, Metropolis. And I kind of wondered, would we have had those amazing images if those films weren't silent? Because as soon as you add sound, you've got stuff coming from everywhere.
Question. Yeah. And I almost think, too, had we had the sound, it might have taken away from the images. Because when you see a silent movie, you're either busy watching the captions or you're just completely absorbed in the set.
Right.
So that is interesting. I never thought about it that way.
And as I think I started to allude to, you associate a number of the decades with particular styles. And I found it interesting, too, that one of the thrusts seemed to be that, at least in what we think of as the golden age of cinema, it's like the films, the design styles in the set, it's like brain chemistry, which both influences and is influenced by behavior. It seemed like there was also kind of that duality in terms of styles that were popular and styles that became popular because of the movies.
The interesting thing to me, too, when I was doing the research, is from about 1910 to 1929, everything was the big epic film, as you mentioned, Ben-Hur, Thief of Baghdad, and they were creating cities literally on a back lot. And so many of the architects in Germany fled, you know, things were happening over there, and came to Hollywood for work and, of course, became art directors. And I just found that so fascinating that they were so adept at the time to build all this. It was just amazing. Because you wouldn't think back then that you probably just had, a small room and they'd shoot everything in that and that would be it. So I found that really fascinating. And of course, it's hard to kind of pigeonhole the 20s. For me, I think it was really more about the big epic films. And then towards the very end of the decade, that's when it started getting into Art Deco. Cedric Gibbons, who of course was one of the founding fathers, he was at MGM for decades. decades. And I think he did was credited for over 150 films, something crazy like that. But he was really the person that brought Art Deco to the cinema. And I think he had a huge part in fashioning Art Deco as we know it now. Because those films in the 20s and the 30s were all very heavily into Art Deco, Art Nouveau. And it made Hollywood, you know, what it is today. I mean, you look at the theaters, a lot of them have that Art Deco. A lot of them still do. They're landmarks all over Hollywood.
Yeah, the movie palaces. And as I recall, it was an Art Deco, maybe the first acknowledged Art Deco design in a film where it was determined there are not going to be any more painted flats. It's going to be three-dimensional.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. And so Cedric was very, you know, in on that as well. I mean, he liked to be able to go and take a glove and put it down on the mantle and see if there was any dust or not. So in other words, he didn't want any flat backgrounds, which is wonderful. It's interesting because audiences loved Art Deco, but they didn't really want it in their houses. They might have a couple of pieces. And I think it's kind of that way today too. It's a very few homes are all Art Deco. I think Streisand's one of the few I know that had a completely Art Deco house before she had the one she has in Malibu now. So.
Now, in terms of just the approach of the spectrum of art direction, it seems like there are maybe a handful of particular, I don't want to use the word style again, but maybe needs.
Or niche.
Depending upon what sort of film it is. You've got historical films where you want accuracy or historical films that might be really stylized.
Right. But even like Gibbons, his name is credited with Wizard of Oz. He saw a German picture of test tubes and he thought they looked like, I think they were upside down test tubes. And that's how he created Munchkinland. So there is a lot of Art Deco in Wizard of Oz, which you probably wouldn't think of. And also, as we went on into the 30s, we got heavily into that big white set period where they do white on white on white on white. Do you remember the movie Top Hat, which was a lot of black and white? Of course, it was shot in black and white. I think that the white on white sets were, you know, wonderful for big extravaganza movies like a musical, Fred and Ginger type thing. And then also Dinner at Eight, which was the actress.
Jean Harlow.
Thank you. She had white hair, white makeup, white dress. Everything was white in that film. And they used 11 different shades of white, which back then was like, wow, now you can walk into Benjamin Moore and find 200. But that was a big thing, too, in the 30s. And then that kind of went away. And then we went under the 40s into a whole other realm of pictures, mainly film noir, which we'll probably get into in a minute on that.
Yeah. One thing that also stood out reading your book was that had not occurred to me before. I've seen the film at least a couple of times, but other than noticing portions of it, I never really connected it before. And that's Grand Hotel and the geometric theme in that.
And again, these were all architects that work on these movies. I mean, you look at Things to Come, that's another one. That's just a whole city that was created from scratch.
2036 AD, you are catapulted through the centuries, whirled into the great unknown, into an era of glass cities towering to the sun, and a gigantic space gun rocketing passengers to the moon.
But yeah, Grand Hotel, definitely. I think that's definitely a landmark film.
Yeah, with the circles everywhere, you know, the revolving door, the round atrium and everything. Yeah, your book has really motivated me to go back and take another look at some of these films.
I know it's funny because I can sit through some of the worst movies, but if there's a great set, then I'm kind of keyed in watching that.
Yeah. And then when you get into, as I mentioned, historical accurate, historical stylized, but then contemporary, of course, could be any number of things. I mean, just depending upon the setting, if it's in a city and a log cabin, but the art directors have to really pay attention to a lot of those details.
Right. And it was historical films. So many designers I write about, they all, you know, kind of specialize in that area. Especially Sarah Greenwood, who did Pride and Prejudice. She just actually got nominated for an Oscar for Barbie, but she primarily does all the British historical movies. And I think that there's kind of a shorthand for them because they, you know, working out of London, most of those films are shot in England. There's great prop houses. And it's funny, you watch, you know, one picture and you'll see a certain setting and then you'll go watch another movie and then you see, oh, I recognize that chair or that sofa. But they love historical films because there's so much research involved and they really enjoy delving into that. Whereas the stylized historical films is kind of the same thing. But I think of Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette.
I'm afraid the Queen has a somewhat artistic temperament.
It's not too much, is it?
No.
that was, to me, was one of the more stylized historical films. Also, Bridgerton, I think, was that way as well. They took a lot of leeway in creating. It wasn't just everything wasn't perfectly exact, but that's okay. So,
yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of Ken Russell, Baz Luhrmann, some of the things that,
yeah,
that they've
Baz Luhrmann,
done.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. And then it really didn't occur to me, I guess, just because I hadn't given that much thought. I mean, it certainly makes sense. But when you get into films that a lot of which takes place outdoors, something like Dances with Wolves, you don't necessarily think so much about production design because, well, we're outdoors. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, exactly.
Bring the camera and put it here.
Well, get it. But, you know, you look at Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, that was a nightmare shoot with the sand.
Lawrence of Arabia, filmed against a canvas of awesome magnificence.
The English have a great hunger for desolate places.
Oh, right.
They would have, yeah, they'd shoot a scene and then they have to go back and, you know, rake over the tracks that the, you know, the dolly made or the camels or what have you. And yeah, I mean, people forget that the outdoors has to be created. And Westerns are the same way.
Yeah. Well, and in Lawrence, I remember there was something that you indicated in there. They had to effectively kind of paint some of the sand to get the contrast they wanted.
Yeah, they did. They painted black on each side and then white in the middle. They left the white sand in the middle so that, you know, the camera could focus better, I guess, or create, you know.
I would never have thought of something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. And you mentioned noir. Now, this isn't really part of that genre, but in terms of just some of the looks that it had, I think of Citizen Kane.
I was just going to bring that up. Yeah, exactly.
Legendary was the Xanadu where Kublai Khan decreed his stately pleasure dome. Today, almost as legendary as Florida Xanadu, world's largest private pleasure ground.
I mean, with Citizen Kane, you know, Orson Welles kind of blew through the budget very quickly. So they didn't have much money for production design. So the poor production designer, I think it was Perry Ferguson, had to use everything at the RKO prop house, which was very little. So when you look at that movie, especially the Great Hall in Xanadu, when you see that massive fireplace and they use bolts and bolts of black velvet to kind of make it seem like a bigger space and also to kind of fill, you know, that's a few pieces they had to kind of fill in to make it look like it was an opulent, you know, Mar-a-Lago type setting, which of course it was not. So,
yeah. And I think that brings me to a term that you used in there that I had not encountered before. I mean, I was a theater major. I took stagecraft in high school. I took some production classes in college. I don't remember ever running into the term, and I may botch the pronunciation of it, chiaroscuro?
It's chiaroscuro.
Okay, that.
Yeah, I know. Believe me, I botched it too. But yeah, it's chiaroscuro. Yeah. And it's that, yeah, that's just basically low in contrast, low and high contrast lighting. And I think, you know, it's wonderful for film noir movies because, you know, you need all those dark angles and shadows, et cetera, to kind of create an illusion of fear, which I think they do wonderfully with that. But I think it sort of started with the German expressionist movie, the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I always get that wrong. I think it started with that. But you know, film noir would not be what it is without the contrast of high and low. This wouldn't be.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there's a particular memorable scene in any movie that really,
you know, I think
shows
it was
that
really
off.
Useful in Casablanca. I mean, it was used in small doses, but still, I always kind of felt like that was a good example. I'd probably say Dr. Caligari's Cabinet would be the best example. Laura, I think it probably had some in there. Trying to think of, there's some Robert Mitchum movies that are come to my mind in a minute. I always felt like he was always lurking in the shadows.
Out
Just about
past,
any
maybe,
40s or 50s film you saw that was film noir was going to have that shadow effect.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of just cool stories woven through your book on the different.
And I love gossip. I love gossip and backstories. Turner Classic movies usually these great backstories. I wish they come back and do them, but maybe they're afraid they'd get sued. But there's always good stories about what went on in the background.
Yeah, one that stood out to me was, and I don't know, this I don't think would really qualify as gossip, but I just found it interesting. The movie The Fountainhead, the adaptation of the Ayn Rand novel, which concerns an architect.
Right.
I don't want to really tell the story, but I just find the irony of the critical reactions in there. So if you can weave that one.
It's amazing because, you know, really that was one of the first big films about architects. And the architectural community, especially in New York, hated the movie. Absolutely hated it.
Dominique.
Hello, Peter.
What a pleasure to see you again. You look more beautiful than ever. Tell me, what do you think of this building? I've been trying to take a poll among the guests.
A what?
A poll of opinion about it.
What for? In order to find out what you think of it yourself?
We have to consider public opinion, don't we?
And interestingly, this supposedly thinly veiled story about Frank Lloyd Wright, and Warner's actually approached Frank Lloyd Wright to do the designs for the movie, and he wanted $250,000, and they said, no thanks. And Perry Ferguson, I think it was, also did that. I read, too, that after the movie came out, you know, again, it was, you know, all the critics hated it and architects hated it, but yet it doubled, tripled attendance in architectural school. So a lot of people ran out to become architects.
But didn't you say that on the one hand, the architectural people, the architects, hated it because of the designs that were portrayed?
And the interesting thing is that it set the designs for the future of New York apartment buildings with, you know, the wraparound terraces and the floor to ceiling windows, and the staircases are kind of free floating. They were kind of ahead of their time. So, yeah, people may not have liked it then, but 10, 20 years later, they're all adopting those looks. So.
Yeah. And you mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright. Well, he ties into another movie that's a favorite of mine, my favorite Hitchcock film, North by Northwest.
Yeah. And, you know, they've just restored that. I think they're showing that in a couple of weeks at the Turner Classic Festival in L.A.
I wasn't aware of that. But apparently his architecture, his designs influenced the house shown as belonging to James Mason.
Yeah. The Van Damme character. The villain. Yeah. Yeah. And that was basically a matte painting. I mean, they did everything on the, you know, on the soundstage. And they wanted to create, especially the Van Damme house, they wanted to create it like a jungle gym because Carrie has to climb up all these, you know, levels to get to Eva Marie Saint to save the heroine. My favorite, though, was the fact that Hitchcock went around bragging to everybody that they were going to be able to shoot the scene at Mount Rushmore. And the Department of Interiors caught wind of it and said, not so fast. You can't do that. So he sends Robert Boyle, his longtime production designer, sends him to climb Mount Rushmore and take measurements and pictures. It's one of the man wasn't killed. So they ended up doing on the back lot.
Yeah. Now, I had been under the impression, though, that the scene, okay, spoiler alert, where Eva Marie Saint pretends to shoot Cary Grant in the visitor center there with the famous little blooper, that was actually shot, though, at that visitor center, that they were able to do that.
Yeah. I think that was it. I mean, I can see why the government wouldn't want people climbing up on the faces. I mean, that's going to wreak all sort of havoc. So who knows what's going to happen there? Maybe they just didn't want to be liable for it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, it's such a great film.
Yeah. Now, again, I consider myself a pretty broadly knowledgeable film buff, but this is an area where there just aren't that many names that I was familiar with before your book, certainly. But there is one, as a James Bond fan, and that's Ken Adam. And
listen, the best interview ever I had was with Ken Adam, and he wrote me a note afterwards. I'm going to find it and frame it because it was just so lovely. Because I grew up, I was a child of the 60s, and I always joke my parents were too cheap to get a babysitter, so they took me to Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, all the Bond films, etc. And I was a Bond freak from then on, and I'm just so fascinated with Ken Adam's career and fact that, you know, he fled Nazi Germany with his family and was in the Royal Air Force, and I think he, you know, helped construct stations for everybody to go through to hide during bombings and transported all that knowledge into his Bond films. I mean, you look at You Only Live Twice with the spaceship. I mean, they did that to scale. It's supposed to land a volcano. Obviously, that was on the back lot. But I just think his work's incredible. And the other thing I loved about all the Bond films is it incorporated a lot of modernism, a lot of, you know, mid-century furniture that the 60s. I mean, there had some. I mean, there's always a lair that some, you know, evil character lived in with a cat in his lap. But they were, you know, just incredible settings.
Yeah, the thing that surprised me about that was learning that he didn't just design the sets and everything, but he was also involved in the creation of the gadgets.
Oh, yeah. Like the gyrocopter and You Only Live Twice that, you know, you could, you know, was constructed in like 3 seconds when I pulled it out of the luggage.
Right. Now pay attention. Two machine guns fixed. Synchronized to what?
100 yards. We're using incendiaries and high explosives. 2 rocket launchers, forward firing on either side.
Fine.
Now, these fire heat-seeking air-to-air missiles, 60 a minute.
Good.
Flame guns, 2 of them, firing astern.
What range?
80 yards. 2 smoke ejectors next door to them. Aerial mines. Now remember, use them only when directly above target. Well, that's about the lot, I think. You know the rest, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I might have run across that information at some point years ago reading a book about the Bond movies, but it's not something that I remembered. So that came as a surprise.
Yeah. It's funny. I look at all these guys and they all live till their 90s. I mean, Robert Doyle was teaching, I think, at UCLA or maybe USC at like 99. I mean, it's just incredible. And I wonder how they would fare today with all the CGI. I wonder what they would think about what films are like now. Because to me, I think the earlier films before all this gadgetry and CGI, et cetera, smoke and mirrors was much better. But that's just my opinion.
Well, it's...
I know you couldn't do a Star Wars now without that.
So. Yeah. I mean, it's the difference between being hands-on, and that's got to, just from a psychological and emotional standpoint of the artist, make a big difference. Mm-hmm. I am crafting something with his hands as opposed to his fingertips on the keyboard.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ken Adam is really influenced by Casablanca. They said that was the number one film that shaped his career. And he loved what was called invisible style, which you'll see, like, let's just take Casablanca, for example. You'll see Rick's Place. You'll see a table that's empty, but it's like half-filled martini glasses and cigarettes are still smoldering in the ashtray. And you can tell somebody had been there 5 minutes ago, but probably had to flee because the Nazis were coming. And so he sort of kept that in mind as he was doing his designs, which I think is, you know, really interesting. That's, again, something you would never think about, but plays such a huge part of the narrative. And I think that's what production design does. Without that, the narrative would just be kind of shot. And costume design also plays into that as well, but you kind of need to see that for all the setup.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious because I have the sense that, at least in terms of, you read about some cinematographers, for instance, who were just brilliant at doing things black and white, like Greg Tolan, Citizen Kane, for instance. Right. I'm just wondering, are there any instances of art directors who were brilliant in things that they did in black and white, but maybe if they then did some color films, it was more mundane and unimpressive, and vice versa?
Yeah, because I'm trying to think of who did black and white and then who did color. So that's why that was a tough one to answer. I have to really think further on that one. But, you know, I think who excelled at black and white was Anton Grout, who, you know, did a lot of film noir pictures. And so I think his work was brilliant in it because he just was kind of the master of all that. I think if you think of black and white, you kind of go to him. But I don't recall him doing anything in color. So, I look at something like most recently with Maestro, which, you know, I felt like that really should have gotten nominated for an Academy Award, but it didn't. But anyway, for production design and a lot of other things as well. Of course, that had a lot of black and white in it as well as color. So I think that designers tell me it's harder to work in black and white than it is color. And getting all the elements, the color hues registered, et cetera, that people say they have a tougher time with it.
Is there any particular film that's kind of legendary for its design challenges?
I would have to say Cleopatra. And that's mainly because of all the stuff going on off the set. I mean, there's a great documentary on the making of Cleopatra. If you've never seen it, I highly recommend it if you can find it. But when they were filming that was going to be, you know, one of the biggest pictures of the 60s. And at the time, one of the most expensive pictures. They just really blew through the budget and then some.
Elizabeth Taylor as Cleopatra, siren of the Nile. Her stunning beauty and notorious intrigue turned the tide of civilization. Richard Burton as Mark Antony, rash, impetuous leader of once invincible legion, dreaded adversary on the field of battle, but a pawn in the arms of this woman.
All that I shall ever want to hold, or look upon, or be, or have, is here now with you.
Rex Harrison as Julius Caesar, who ruled half the world by sheer might. But Caesar's dream of conquest included the ambitious Cleopatra at his side.
Do as you say, literally, as if I was something you had conquered.
If I choose to regard you as such,
Am I to understand then that you feel free to do with me whatever you want? Whenever you want?
Yes, I want that understood.
On your knees.
You dare ask the proconsul of Rome?
I asked it of Julius Caesar. I demand it of you.
But they wanted to film in Rome because obviously it's Cleopatra, and weren't allowed to because there was the Olympics were going on. So they ended up going to Pinewood Studios in London and were, you know, building Egypt in London. And you've got, you know, the rain and was, you know, chipping away all the buildings that had fresco on them. And of course, they were having to ship in daily new palm trees. Those were all withering. So they blew through that budget and then finally had to go over to Rome. And then, of course, they encountered all sorts of problems with rain season and also all the antics were going on, you know, not on the set, in the back of the set with Liz Taylor, et cetera. So I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges I've heard about.
Okay. Do you have a personal favorite art director in terms of their body of work?
Yeah, I'd probably Ken Adam. I'd have to go back to that because besides all the Bond films, I mean, he did Dr. Strangelove.
Right.
So you gay, must test your capacity before, eh? You're mustering for it. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Well, what are some others that he did? Because that's all that immediately springs to my mind. Okay, James Bond, Dr. Strangelove, but I know he did more. And
yeah, nothing comes to mind right now. I'll have to look that up and get back to you on that. Because nothing else comes to mind, because those are the two things I think about as well.
Yeah, well, they certainly stand out.
Yeah.
Is there a film that you now? Because one thing I noticed in the book, it seems like most of the films in there were ones that were successful, either box office hits or had major reputations of some sort. But there are a lot of films that pop into my mind that I think may have had some really interesting stories on the production design and so forth. I think of even something as simple as one of my favorite films is Champagne for Caesar. Uh-huh. And there's a scene where Ronald Colman comes to apply for a job at the My Lady Soap Company run by Vincent Price. And the lobby, the reception area is very stylized, very interesting with the design on that. So I think of something like that, or a personal favorite film of mine, Phantom of the Paradise, Brian De Palma. Are there any that maybe didn't make your book even that are really favorites of yours that you think are maybe underappreciated?
There's a wonderful film that Walter Matthau did called A New Leaf. It was a comedy. Beautiful, fantastic sets, all very mid-century modern, but I couldn't find any pictures on it. And the publisher, I think, really wanted to have things that everybody knew about, like a Gone with the Wind or a Wizard of Oz or whatever. So believe me, if I could have put in minor films that still had great sets, I would have done that. But there either are a lot of pictures out there or there's nothing. It's one or the other.
Well, feast or famine.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, if you were to, we talked earlier about there being different styles. I mean, you know, we talked about historical, accurate, mm-hmm. historical, stylized, contemporary, fantasy, sci-fi, and then outdoors things. Maybe springboarding off of that, although it doesn't have to be that strict, would you have like a top five of films that would hit those different markers?
Yeah. And it's funny. I think they're all from the 60s. If I had to really narrow it down, I loved all the Doris Day films she did with Rock Hudson. They were great, wonderful mid-century interiors. So that's kind of that niche. Dr. Zhivago, I thought was brilliant in their production design. And, you know, you talk about films that were challenging. They filmed that, the Ice Palace. He would meet with Laura, his mistress, with Dr. Zhivago. And they filmed that in Spain in the dead of the summer. And it's all done with wax. So that was extremely challenging because you have to make the wax look like ice. I thought those were incredible interiors. And then again, the Bond films, because they bring in sort of the fantasy sci-fi area.
Now, your book, when was the book published? It's been a couple of years.
2012,
or so, right?
Yeah.
2012. Okay, so it's been a little longer than I thought. Mm-hmm. So that leaves a pretty decent window of a lot of other films that have come along since then. Now, are there any particular ones that have really impressed you over the last dozen years?
I loved Maestro. I thought the work they did was incredible in creating Carnegie Hall and the offices and the apartments that I never even knew existed in that. And I love some of the, you know, the sets too of the apartments in New York. I thought they just did a great job with that. Of course, a lot of people would say Poor Things. Of course, it won the Oscar this year. That was such a fantasy film. It kind of, I think it was such a wild film. The design was probably secondary. But and then also, I'd probably go back to, I'm a big World War II junkie, so I'd probably go back to some of the war films. I think Saving Private Ryan was brilliant. I mean, look at what they did, creating an entire town in France to be blown up that was filmed outside of London. I mean, it's some of those films that you just see, you go and you just don't, you know, you think about it, the production design, it's sort of secondary because you're so wedded to what the characters are doing. But it's just, I thought that was a brilliant film.
One that seems to be sort of a hybrid, that's probably the wrong word for me to use, but at least in terms of my mind, Chicago. Mm-hmm. I saw a stage production of it in LA a number of years ago. Wasn't that wild about it. Saw the movie, really liked the movie. And yet the movie incorporates
a lot of
stage feel to how it's presented. So that's what I meant by hybrid. It seemed to kind of meet it halfway, and I thought it worked really well. And of course, that's one of them that's in your book.
Yeah.
In fact, if I sat here and just read through all the movies in your book and took a moment to just think about and appreciate them, there'd be no time for this conversation because there are so many in there. I mean, you got Wizard of Oz on the front cover, for one thing, and you mentioned some of what went into that. And the others, I mentioned Chicago, 2001, of course, Space Odyssey. That's a unique and very memorable look. More recently, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Mm-hmm. And just the scope of that.
So that's almost a whole other book on sci-fi. To me, that's just a whole other realm that's a lot harder to design and really more computer generated, of course. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing, is it's no disrespect to the people who are able to accomplish that with computers and so forth. It's some amazing work, but it's
also interesting. If you look at the history of production design up until the '60s, it was all males working on film. It wasn't any women in the, you know, production design departments.
Yeah. I was wondering about that because that's why I was going to be, phrasing a question earlier. I don't remember which one. Well, I guess I managed to do it, but when I was anticipating asking it, I was going to ask, you know, is there anyone who, you know, he, and then modifying he or she, and then it crossed my mind, although I don't remember reading about any women.
Yeah, I know.
In your book.
I mean, there, Janine Applewall, Patrizia von Brandenstein, which did Amadeus, and she's got a huge body of work, and she's still working. A lot of these women are still working well into their, you know, 60s to 80s, which I think is great.
Yeah.
But you just don't see as many. You see a lot of set decorators, female set decorators, but not so many production designers. And I think that's going to change. But
yeah, no doubt. But in any case, it does sort of reinforce the phrase founding fathers in terms of the early ones who established the art form.
One of the most popular directors who's also gets very heavily involved in production design is Nancy Myers, because she does all those great films like Something's Gotta Give and The Holiday and, you know, kind of rom-coms for women of a certain age. But the sets are just incredible. Her Hamptons Beach House in Something's Gotta Give was one of the most copied sets ever in the history of Hollywood. I mean, it just spun off into products and everybody wanted that look.
All right. Well, I should throw it open because the questions, again, not having a lot of depth of knowledge on this, I mean, I kind of had to really think through, you know, what are some decent questions that I can be asking? And so I'm sure there are a number of things that just haven't occurred to me. I mean, are there any really cool stories or areas that we haven't touched on that you want to share with us?
Funny, I had to laugh at one of your questions. What was my most memorable movie going experience?
Oh, we haven't gotten to that. Spoiler alert.
Well, this is actually a comic story here, but my neighbor growing up decided to take me and her daughter to the movies, and she took us to Midnight Cowboy. Now, granted, we were like 10 years old, and she thought it was a Western. And it wasn't until, like, I was in my 20s, I finally got to see that.
Yeah. What's that X on the poster for? Oh, that's a brand they put on cattle.
I can see how she would have thought that, but within the first 5 minutes, I mean, we were yanked out of the scene. Mm. But anyway, yeah, you know, to me, one of the best years for film and design was 1939, because we had The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, you know, against each other for production design. They ended up naming the designer to Gone with the Wind. He got an honorary Oscar. William Cameron Menzies, another founding father, and that's when they changed over to the term production design. But it's funny because, and I'm of course from the South, if you can pick up from my accent, but it's funny, Gone with the Wind was such a big film, especially with the South. And now it's kind of controversial, but the writer, Margaret Mitchell, absolutely hated the movie. They came to, David Selznick sent his people down. He wanted to find a Tara down in Atlanta. Of course, everything was burned and nothing really had been rebuilt at the time. From the Civil War, nothing on the scale that he wanted. And so they ended up bringing back Georgia red clay so he could mimic that for the, you know, the land. And then he built Tara on the backstage at 12 acres, I think it was called. Yeah. But anyway, so they pulled in Margaret Mitchell to see what she could contribute to the film. And she had a fit that they had, you know, the double staircase that you see in 12 Oaks, things like that. She just said would never be in the South. And her comment was, I didn't know whether to laugh, cry or vomit. Okay. There's a review.
Yeah. No kidding. Oh, wow.
Just so much of this design too, production design, I think a lot of it's method acting design, because they really do help the characters get into their role. When I was interviewing Dean Tavalaris, he did The Conversation with Gene Hackman and also
and Rumblefish, which I worked on.
Mm. Oh, okay. And also he did Apocalypse Now, which was it, and in The Godfather. And for the Godfather, he did when, you know, that great scene in Godfather 1 when they're all sitting around making pasta and that, you know, he opens the cabinet and you kind of see a couple of cans, but you know it's tomatoes, but he literally figured out what tomatoes were popular in the 40s and that's what they put on the cans just to get the characters in the mood. For the conversation, Gene Hackman would pull open a drawer and he would see business cards, cigarettes, and all sorts, you know, mail that would have, you know, his character's name on it, again, just to get them in the mood. And so much of that plays a huge role in the whole narrative storytelling process.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. Well, so normally this would be the point where I would ask you your most memorable movie going experience, but I think we already got that.
So. Oh, I snuck into The Graduate growing up. That was another memorable experience.
Oh, really?
Actually, that was one of my favorite films, The Graduate. I just thought that was just wonderfully done. Dick Silver, who did the movie, told me, he said, we found two houses that were Alpine style in Los Angeles, and they were kind of in the same neighborhood. These were characters are a bit nouveau, climbing the ladder, country club, money, et cetera. And for Mrs. Robinson, everything was round doorways, round stairwell, base. And for the Benjamin's family, everything was square. And something you would even never think about. But also they worked with a costume designer to create sort of a wardrobe for her that was very predatory. And they did the patio. They enclosed that, put the bar out there, which was very 60s. I think every 60s film always has a bar. It's always incredible how that's always in there. They put her sort of in a leopard outfit because she was a predator. Yeah. with Benjamin. So,
yeah, I hadn't thought of that before, but yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Well, they all work very closely with the costume designers because they kind of have to. I mean, you may imagine the costumes all in a pink color and then they do a pink room. Of course, it would never work. So those two things play off each other. The amazing thing to me, too, is everybody can pretty much name a costume designer and they can name a director, but they can't really name a production designer unless they're a film buff.
Right.
A lot of people don't stay for the credits.
Yeah, that's true.
There's that. Yeah.
Unless it's a Marvel movie and it's like, okay, get to the next scene. All right. Well, Kathy, I just really appreciate you spending the time with me to talk about this subject. I hope Thanks everybody found it as interesting as I have. And again, you know, even if you don't want to read the book, just own it because it's it's going to wow you.
Funny, when it first came out, I was a little disappointed because I wanted a big size coffee table book, but somebody said it fits perfectly on top of the other big size coffee table books. So she's kind of right because it's the length made it more.
That's true. Yeah, and it's printed on the nice glossy paper stock, so the photos really jump out at you. I mean, whether they're color or glorious black and white. I mean,
well, we had the hardest time deciding on what was going to be on the cover. And I'm glad that my editor, Judith Reagan, a publisher came up with Wizard of Oz scene. And that was a painted backdrop. And that was totally a, you know, photo fest picture. I had never even seen that picture before. So I was thrilled to get that.
And then on the back, you've got the King and I.
Yeah. 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 John DeCore, he was just an incredible artist. He did King and I and tons of other films that are leaving my head right now, but he was really noted for doing these beautiful sketches, beautiful artwork. And I think that it's just another art in itself. And there's a wonderful book out there called Film Art for your listeners if they're looking for something else to read on the subject.
Well, and another thing about it too, for people who don't necessarily appreciate just really intensely scholarly works with long, bulky paragraphs of information, most of which you won't retain, this one has a nice balance. The pictures are big. The text is lean, but informative. And so it's just nicely balanced and really nice to look at.
Because that was kind of our goal. We didn't want to put people to sleep and get, because you can't get so super technical. And I think that's the biggest thing about a lot of film books that are out there. They're really for the heavy duty technician. I mean, they're really hard to grasp, I think. So.
Well, and as I said, you can get a look at Kathy's book on the Movie Nights and Matinees website. Go to the bookshelf page. There will be an image there and you can click on it. It will take you to Amazon where you can look at the book in more detail and presumably order it. Of course, as I'm saying this, I'm trying to remember, is it still readily available that way?
Yeah, they've just reprinted. They're reprinting another batch at the end of April. So the book will be out in bookstores, but you definitely can get it cheaper on Amazon. as we all know.
All right. Well worth it for your movie reference library. So once again, Kathy, thank you for joining me on Movie Nights and Matinees.
I enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
In addition to checking out Kathy's book, Designs on Film, on the bookshelf page of the podcast website, a bunch of the movies featured in her book and or discussed in our conversation can be found on the Screening Room page. Don't forget to click on the follow, subscribe, or download button wherever you listen, and please leave a rating and, where possible, a review. And remember to visit the Movie Nights and Matinees Facebook page, where you can leave more detailed comments or questions and find additional material related to the podcast episode topics, or maybe to classic movies in general. I seem to be back on my usual schedule, so be sure to watch for episode 30 in a couple of weeks.
When you're dismissed, you will walk your horses for half an hour, then water and picket them. The sutler's store will remain open until 12 o'clock.